From this, it becomes clear that Reuben is the firstborn of Jacob, while Levi is the firstborn of Israel. The one carries off the seniority of time, the other that of rank and power. For of toil and progress, of which Jacob is the symbol, the beginning is a good natural endowment, in respect of which he is called Reuben, but of the contemplation belonging to the only wise one, in respect of which he is ranked as Israel, the source is a disposition toward service, and the sign of that service is Levi. Just as Jacob is found to be heir of Esau's birthright, since eagerness for vice is overcome by toil directed toward the good, so too the birthright of Reuben's good natural endowment will be carried off by Levi, who has laid hold of complete virtue. The clearest proof of that completeness is to have become a refugee to God, abandoning all preoccupation with the realm of becoming. These, properly speaking, are the deliverances and ransoms of a soul that longs for freedom. And perhaps this also introduces a doctrine altogether necessary, that every wise person is a ransom for the base one, who would not last even a short while were it not that the wise one, exercising mercy and forethought, took thought beforehand for his preservation, like a physician set against a patient's illnesses, making them milder or removing them altogether, unless they should force their way with an uncontrollable onrush and overwhelm even the care of treatment. For thus Sodom too was destroyed, since no good was found able, as on a scale, to outweigh the untold multitude of evils. Whereas if the number 50 had been found, by which release from slavery for the soul and complete freedom are proclaimed, Leviticus 25:10, or any of the numbers after it, down to which the wise Abraham is recorded to have fixed the reduction at the number 10 of instruction, the mind would not have perished so ingloriously, Genesis 18:24 FF. Yet one must try to save, so far as possible, even those who are altogether doomed to be destroyed by the vice within them, imitating good physicians, who, even when they see that recovery is impossible for the sick, nevertheless gladly administer treatment, so that nothing contrary to their intention may seem to happen through their own negligence. And if even some small seed of health shows itself, this must be fanned into flame, like a spark, with every care. For there is hope that, once it is drawn out and grown, it will yield a better and more sure-footed life. For my own part, whenever I see one of the earnest men living in a household or a city, I count that household or city blessed, and I believe it will have secure enjoyment of the goods present, and will find the expectation of goods still absent brought to fulfillment, since God bestows his boundless and unbounded wealth for the sake of the worthy, even upon the unworthy. And I pray that such men may live as long as possible, since freedom from old age is not granted them, believing that good things remain with people only for as long as these men are able to live. So whenever I see or hear that one of them has died, I am deeply downcast and grieved, and I mourn no less for the living than for them. For to these men it falls, by the natural course, to meet their necessary end, having received a happy life and a glorious death. But I mourn for those left bereft of the great and powerful hand by which they were kept safe, since they will very soon feel their own troubles, unless nature, in place of the former ones, provides that new fruits sprout up again for nourishment and enjoyment of those able to use them, as a tree does, shedding fruit already ripened. Just as good men are a city's strongest safeguard for its permanence, so too, of the city that each of us constitutes composed of soul and body, the most secure foundation is furnished by those lovers of prudence and knowledge, the words of reason, which the lawgiver, using a metaphor, calls ransoms and firstborn, for the reasons I have already given. It is for this reason, too, that he says the cities of the Levites are redeemers forever. Lev. 25:32, because the one who serves God has reaped eternal freedom, receiving successive healings in accordance with the continual turnings of the ever-moving soul. For the fact that they become redeemers not once but forever, as he says, implies this thought, that the soul is always turning and always being set free, the turning arising from its being mortal by nature, the freedom being made secure by the grace of its benefactor, whose portion it has obtained by lot. It is worth considering, not as a side matter, why in the world he assigned the cities of the Levites to the fugitives, deeming it fitting that those who seemed unholy should dwell together with the most holy, these being the ones who committed involuntary manslaughter. We must say, first, what follows from what was said before? That the worthy man is a ransom for the worthless, so that it is fitting that those who have gone astray should come to those who are consecrated, for the sake of being purified. And next, that the Levites admit fugitives because they themselves are, in a sense, fugitives too. For just as those men are driven from their homelands, so these two have left behind children, parents, brothers, their nearest and dearest, in order that in place of a mortal portion they might find the immortal one. But they differ in this. For the former the flight is unwilling, caused by an involuntary deed, while for the latter the departure is voluntary, out of love for what is best. And in this too, that for the former the Levites are a refuge, while for the Levites themselves the ruler of all is the refuge, so that the former have as an incomplete law the sacred word, while these latter have as their law the very God whom they serve as priests. Furthermore, those who committed involuntary manslaughter were allotted to dwell in the very same cities as the Levites, because they too were deemed worthy of special privilege on account of a holy killing. For when the soul, having turned aside, honored the Egyptian god, the body, as though it were gold, then all the sacred words of reason, self-summoned, rushed forth armed with weapons of defense, the proofs that come by knowledge setting over themselves as leader and general the high priest, prophet, and friend of God, Moses, and waged an undeclared war on behalf of piety, and did not cease until they had utterly destroyed all the doctrines of their opponents. So it is fitting that those who performed like actions, even if not identical, should have become fellow dwellers, having performed the same deeds. There is also a certain account told among secret teachings, which one ought to entrust to the ears of the older, having stopped the ears of the younger against it. Among the powers surrounding God, all best of their kind, one, equal in honor to the others, is the legislative power, for God himself is lawgiver and source of laws, from whom all particular lawgivers derive, and this power is by nature divided in two. On the one side toward beneficence for those who act rightly, on the other toward punishment for those who sin. Of the former division, then, the Levite is the servant, for he undertakes all the ministrations that pertain to the complete priesthood, by which the mortal is brought into fellowship with and made known to God, whether through whole burnt offerings, or through offerings of preservation, or through offerings of repentance for sins. Of the latter, the punitive division, those who commit involuntary manslaughter have become servants. And Moses bears witness to this, saying, "But he did not act willingly, rather God delivered him into his hands," Exod 21:13, "so that the hands of this man are taken up as instruments, while the one who acts invisibly through them, unseen, is another the unseen one." Let there dwell together, then, two attendants who are servants of the twofold kind of legislative power, of the one that leads toward benefaction, the Levite, of the one that leads toward punishment, the one who kills unintentionally. "On the day," he says, "when I struck every firstborn in the land of Egypt, I consecrated to myself every firstborn in Israel," Num. 3:13. Not that we should suppose this happened only at that time when Egypt was struck with the great plague of destruction upon its firstborn, that the firstborn of Israel became holy, but rather that this is the natural course of events for the soul, both long ago and now and again and always. Whenever the ruling faculties of blind passion are destroyed, then the offspring of the soul that sees God keenly become holy, elder, and honored. For the departure of vice brings about the entrance of virtue, just as, conversely, when the good withdraws, the evil that lies in wait comes in upon it. Thus, scarcely had Jacob gone out, Gen 27:30, when Esau at once presented himself to the all-receiving mind, ready to stamp it, if he could, with the marks of vice instead of the impressions of virtue. Yet he could not manage to accomplish this, for having been supplanted and disinherited by the wise man, he found himself outstripped before he could take his revenge for what he suffered. He brings the first fruits not only from the firstborn, but also from the fat portions, showing that all that is joyous, rich, protective, and pleasing in the soul must be surrendered to God. And I observe in the arrangements for sacrifices that three things are prescribed to be offered up from the victims as the choicest parts: fat, kidneys, and the lobe of the liver, Lev 3:3ff. About which we shall speak separately, but nowhere the brain or the heart, which one would have expected to be consecrated before the others? If indeed, according to the lawgiver, the ruling faculty is acknowledged to reside in one of these two. But perhaps, in perfect holiness and after careful consideration, he did not bring them up to God's altar, because the ruling faculty, in indivisible intervals of time, undergoes many turns toward either the better or the worse, and receives ever-changing impressions, now of pure and approved coinage, now of debased and counterfeit. The region, then, that has received both of these contending qualities, the noble and the shameful, and is disposed toward each alike, and assigns equal honor to both, the lawgiver, judging it no less unclean than sacred, brought down from the divine altar. For the shameful is profane, and the profane is altogether unholy. But this ruling faculty he has set apart, and if it should undergo judgment, then, once all its parts have been purified, it will be offered as a whole burnt offering, unblemished and undefiled. For this is the law of whole burnt offerings, that nothing be left over for the created being except the refuse of food and the hide, which are marks of bodily weakness, not of vice, while all else, whatever furnishes the soul entire in all its parts, is to be wholly burnt to God.